Okay, so welcome back again. We can continue our exploration of dependent origination. And we have been looking a little bit at the idea of upadana, of clinging, is how it's translated here, of this idea of grasping onto things, holding onto things like views and opinions and also, of course, all the things that we own in the world is part of that attachment and grasping that we do. So now we're going to have a look at another short sutta which talks about this particular topic and to understand a little bit better how it fits into the sequence of dependent arising and how we can actually use this in a certain practical way to actually help us on the path as well, of course. This is really what it comes down to at the end of the day, is how we can use these things to enhance our practice and to make sure we're actually heading in the right direction for more happiness, less problems and less suffering in life. Okay, so this sutta is called Clinging, Upadana in Pali, from the Sanghita Nikaya. All of these suttas are from the Nidana Sanghita, the Sanghita on causation or conditionality, if you like. Okay, so this is how it goes. At Savati, because when one dwells contemplating gratification in things that can be clung to, craving increases. With craving as condition, attachment comes to be. With attachment as conditions, there is existence. And with existence as condition, there is birth. With birth as condition, there is old age and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So this here is quite straightforward, a fairly simple sutta, really. The problem here is this idea of contemplating gratification. Pali word for gratification is asada, and it means like the pleasure in things, the happiness in things, the what you get out of things, right? So of course, when you contemplate the positive aspect of things, then because of that, you start to crave for that thing even more. So whenever you think about the positive aspect of something, craving increases as a consequence. It's fairly obvious, right? It's fairly obvious why that has to be the case. So if you think about the advantage of owning a big house compared to a small house, or you think how nice it is to have a nice car compared to an ordinary car, you think whatever it is that you contemplate the advantage of something, craving will increase in that area, and this will then lead to discontent, and it will lead to you pursuing these things and all this other stuff. And that's why from craving comes then upadana again. You actually go out and get this, right? Oh, you contemplate this beautiful car you want to get for a long time. Craving increases, and eventually you take the action, right? And even though you have to borrow money to get this car, your craving is so strong. Okay, got to have this car, so you go and buy the car as a consequence. And it's the same thing with so many things in life. The more we crave for things, the more we're willing to sacrifice to get them. You attach to it, and then because of that attachment, then you are then establishing your mind in that, again, re-establishing, reconfirming that you are existing in that realm. Your mind is focused on these things, preoccupied with these things, thinking about this new car, right? You are established, existing in the sensual realm. It's like a mental existence, an existence inside of us. And we'll see in a second a bit more detail how this actually, what this looks like according to the suttas. And then because your mind is established in a certain way, when you die, it continues on in roughly that kind of existence in the future. And then, of course, you keep on going around and around, right? And this is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. You don't stop things in that way. And there's a nice simile here to describe this. Suppose, bhikkhus, suppose everyone, a great bonfire was burning, consuming 10, 20, 30, or 40 loads of wood. And a man cast dry grass, dry cow dung, and dry wood into it from time to time. Thus sustained by that material, fueled by it, that great bonfire would burn for a very long time. So too, when one lives contemplating gratification in things, that can be clung to, craving increases. Such is the whole, is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. So when you contemplate the gratification, you are adding fuel to the fire of desire, the fire of greed, and coming with that is also the fire of ill will and delusion as well, of course. So this is when you contemplate gratification. But then, of course, there is the opposite, right? There is the reverse. How does the reverse work? And this is because when one dwells contemplating the danger in things that can be clung to, craving ceases, or it declines, and eventually it ceases when you keep on contemplating it long enough. And with the cessation of craving comes the cessation of attachment. With the cessation of attachment, the cessation of existence. And then the cessation of birth, the cessation of old age and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair. All of that ceases. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering here. So this is the good news part of the story here. The end of suffering here. And it starts off with contemplating the danger in things, right? Okay. You get that new car, right? So what? Big deal, you get a new car. After a while, you get fed up with that car and you want another one. And you see that this craving, this contemplation of gratification and things is an unending story. It just keeps on going, going, going. You are never satisfied, right? You're just fueling this lack of contentment, fueling this desire, which always just goes on and on and on. You start to see the danger in this looking for gratification in things that actually never can really gratify you at all. And this is the problem. We think there is gratification there. There is some superficial gratification, but it doesn't give any real sustenance. It doesn't really give any final satisfaction. It doesn't give any sense of completion or fulfillment. It's just this endless moving on. There's no end to craving. Craving sustains itself into the future, moving on and on and on. And because of that, it is kind of, we're not going anywhere. Nothing is happening. We're just craving more and more. This self-sustaining process. And after a while, we get a bit worried about that for good reason, because it is just going to keep on like that forever unless we do something about it. So you can see here that one of the things we were talking about yesterday, of course, and somebody was asking about, you just end up hating everything, but that is not really the point. The point is to give you a counterbalance, right? We tend to be so stuck in the world. We tend to think that, everything is so wonderful and beautiful. Actually, I think deep down we realize that there are problems sometimes. But this is to give us a counterbalance to that, to remind us that there are also difficulties with these things. Yes, you crave for that nice car, but in the end, it's not going to satisfy you anyway, right? And if you understand that, if you think about that, instead of pursuing with so much energy, with so much money, with so much of your resources, you pursue things which are so ephemeral and which are not really going to give you any satisfaction anyway, it starts to change your direction in life. And you ask, where can I find some real satisfaction? Where is there real satisfaction in this world? And you turn your mind to more spiritual pursuits instead. And it is that gradual movement of the mind, changing direction from the worldly pursuits to the pursuits that are more inherently satisfactory. The kindness in life, the goodness, the stillness and peace of samadhi and meditation practice. That is where real satisfaction can eventually be found. And even on the early stages of that path, some degree of satisfaction can be found there. So it is a natural turning away, right? It's not something that you shouldn't just take on the word of Buddha and say, right, now I'm going to hate all those things. That is not going to work. It is more the natural inclination of the mind changing as you contemplate these things wisely and you understand what is actually really going on here. That is really the point. So you have to understand this, right? You have to actually see this for yourself. It's not just a dogma, a kind of something you take on board, right, I'm going to believe this. It is something that you have to see with your own wisdom, so to speak, and then it has an effect on your life. Then your mind starts to change and turn around. So please take these teachings in the right way, and then they become very useful for you. So it is, again, it's a natural process, and then it is actually heading in the right direction. And you will find that this will have effects in your life in general, but it also will have effects when you go on a retreat like this. If you're able to see that the ordinary things in life are perhaps not as gratifying as you first thought, your mind will turn away from those things a little bit. And even just a little bit of letting go will have an effect in your meditation practice. One of the main problems in meditation practice, the most difficult things to let go of, is our attachment to the sensory world, right? The body and the sensory world, this is one of the most difficult things. And because we are, as long as we contemplate gratification in that world, as long as we think that there is a degree of happiness to be had, so long we are going to have some degree of attachment. And as long as we are attached to it, you can't let go. Letting go and attachment are exact opposites of each other. So because you're attached, your meditation is only going to take you so far. If you can release a little bit, if you can let go a little bit, if you can reduce your attachment a little bit, it means your meditation will be a little bit deeper as a consequence. So these are like diametrically opposed things. The depth of your meditation compared to your attachment to the sensory world are two almost exact opposites. And the more you let go of one, the more you will be able to access the other one. Okay, and then comes the simile as always. And of course the simile this time is going to be the exact opposite. Suppose, bhikkhus, a great bonfire was burning, consuming 10, 20, 30 or 40 loads of wood. And a man would not cast dry grass, dry cow dung and dry wood into it from time to time. Thus, when the former supply of fuel is exhausted, that great bonfire, not being fed with any more fuel, lacking sustenance, would be extinguished. So too, when one lives contemplating danger in things that can be clung to, craving gradually ceases, and eventually the ceasing happens through all the steps of dependent origination until the whole mass of suffering itself comes to an end. So when you don't fuel the fire gradually dies down on its own. Doesn't happen straight away. Takes a bit of time, but eventually the fire dies down. No more fire. Wow. Peace, calm, quiet. So there you are. Okay, so that is just another way of looking at the links here, craving, attachment and existence, and these links, how they kind of work together, and how we can use these things in a kind of practical sense, to think about them in a way that enhances our practice. Okay, then there is a short sutta called Alms Gatherer. I will leave that one out. I put these suttas together a while ago, and at the time I thought it was a good idea. I'm not really sure now why I put it in there, so I'm just going to leave it out for now. Then we come back to the root sutta that we have been using all along, and this, which is the basic sutta on dependent origination. And now we have come to the link between clinging and existence, or attachment is the condition for existence. And with the cessation of attachment, there is the cessation of existence. What, because, is existence? There are three kinds of existence. Sense sphere existence, form sphere existence, formless sphere existence. This is called existence. So this definition of existence includes all kinds of existence. Sense sphere is like where we are at, the human realm, right? The sensory world of experience and all kinds of things. And the vast majority of beings exist within the sense sphere existence. And there's a massive scope of differences from beings who suffer a lot to beings who live in very kind of refined states of sense sphere existence. Form sphere existence, this is relates to like the jhanas, the samadhi states. That's when you get reborn. If you practice very deep states of samadhi, you can see why that there aren't that many beings there, right? There's not that many beings who attain deep samadhi. And the formless sphere existence, well, there will be even fewer beings there because these are very refined states of samadhi, which is very rare that anyone really accesses these kind of states. But life there is supposed to be incredibly long. So if you go to the formless sphere, according to some suttas, you can live there for thousands of eons, staying in those states. So once you get in there, it's like you are trapped in this bliss, continuous bliss, for long periods of time. So that's a pretty good deal. There's a better deal, of course, that's called Nibbana, but this is getting very close to that. That is what is meant by existence here. Of course, this is just one particular way of dividing up existence. Existence can be subdivided in many, many different ways. There's almost an infinite variety of ways you could divide this thing up. You can think of the animal realm, for example. It's called one realm, but really, the animal realm itself is incredibly diverse, and it could really be divided up into many, many different ways. So there's lots of ways of dividing this thing, all of this up. But the point here is that once you start attaching to things, existence arises as a consequence. So when we, and this is the things I've been talking about yesterday already, the idea here is that there's certain things in the world that are important to us, where we are attached, that we have taken up, certain relationships, certain things we own, right, or what we are, the material possessions that are really important to us, certain ideas we have that are very important to us, the views that we have. So this is where our holding on is in this world. And because we hold on to those things, because they are important to us, our mind tends to revolve around those things. We think about them. We crave for them. You come on retreat, you sit down, and you can see how your mind sometimes it's even often, right? It goes back into the past or into the future, thinking about things which relate to your life in certain ways. And that's where you exist. That's where the mind hangs out, right? You would have tendencies and habits in that direction. So this is what existence means in the suttas. It doesn't really mean a concrete existence, I live here. It means like our mental existence. And that mental existence then, as we saw before, between the links between sankhara and vijnana, once you are established in that way, that establishment of consciousness of the mind tends to carry you forward also into a renewed existence. So existence in the Pali has this twofold idea, really. On the one hand, where the mind is established in this life, that is kind of the kamma existence. You're making kamma in that way because you're established there. And then the consequent rebirth that happens because of that. It's just a continuation, the mind continuing from one to the next one. So it is good to reflect on this sometimes. You know, where are you? Where is your mind? Where are you stuck on? What are your habits? And to see perhaps how your mind also develops over time. And you can see that, you know, there comes a point when if you have a very nice meditation one day, suddenly you start thinking about that meditation more. You start contemplating it more. You start being attracted to that, right? And you can see how your mind is shifting slightly towards meditation instead. You have more interest there. And then when you come back home, instead of being at the meditation retreat, fantasizing about back home, when you're back home, you fantasize about the meditation retreat, right? Wouldn't that be great? Whoa, the meditation retreat. Ooh, I wish I could go back again. And this is what actually happens. If your meditation is going really, really well, you start fantasizing, taking every opportunity to do your meditation practice. The deeper it is, the more that will be the case. The mind is leaning in that direction. And then when you die, because the mind is already leaning towards meditation, samadhi, you tend to go in that direction when you pass away. There's two things here, two things going on, which are important for the rebirth process. One is where the mind is inclining, right, is inclining in a certain way. And then you have the color of the mind. How much good karma have you made? If you made lots of bad karma, the mind will be kind of slightly dark. If you have made lots of good karma, the mind will be bright, right? So where you're heading and also the quality of the mind, these things two together then will be what determines where the mind heads in your next existence, next life. So that is basically how this conditional relationship between upadana and bhava, upadana pachaya bhava, in dependent origination. And then when that attachment ceases, right, when You are no longer really interested in anything. And then your mind is not preoccupied with anything anymore. Your mind doesn't hang out anywhere. It doesn't hang out, is not preoccupied, doesn't think about the future or the past, is not interested in anything in particular that has to do with existence. It's as if inside of you, your mind is not established in anything. It doesn't have any habit, doesn't have an inclination anymore, right? So that's why the Arahat is perfectly mindful. He's just here, or she is just here right now. There is none of this holding on to anything or being established in anything. And that's why when they come to the end of their life, consciousness isn't going anywhere. It doesn't have anywhere to go. It's not interested in anything anymore. So it stops right there instead. And that's so that is how, roughly how that works. Okay. So let's have a look at one sutta. This is quite a well-known sutta that talks about existence from the Anguttara Nikaya. It's actually the name of the sutta itself is actually existence, and it is one of those clearest exposition of how this works. So this is the Venerable Ananda speaking to the Buddha. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Bhante, it is said, existence, existence, bhava, bhava. In what way, Bhante, is there existence? If, Ananda, there were no karma ripening in the sensory realm, would sense sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, karma is the field, consciousness is the seed, and craving the moisture for their consciousness to be established in an inferior realm. In this way, there is production of renewed existence in the future." So, if there is no karma ripening in the sensory realm, of course, it is because our mind is established in that sensory realm in this life. That's why it continues in that sensory realm in the future. So the karma here is basically the level of our mind in this life. So that is why the sensory realm can exist. If that wasn't the case, you couldn't really have the sensory realm. There would be no inclination there. Consciousness wouldn't go there. So there would be no sense sphere existence. It is interesting here, one of the little points here is the way Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates this. He translates it as sense sphere existence and form existence, and or form sphere existence and formless sphere existence. And there is no real word that corresponds to sphere in the Pali. The Pali really just has like sensory existence. It has karma bhava. Right, which means karma is like sensory or sensual existence. And then it has rupa bhava, existence. Form existence means like the luminous, light, bright form that you have in deep samadhi. And it has formless existence. And the problem with adding this idea of sphere, it almost becomes as if, you know, we are living in a certain realm. You are this being, and there is this realm there, right? This sphere of existence. It's like there's the earth, right? And we are little beings, kind of wandering around on this planet, and you are part of this sphere, so to speak. But the Buddhist idea of existence really is a personal experience. What existence is about. When we say sensory existence, it is like that is your personal experience of the world. You experience sensory impact, you experience the desire for those sensory objects, etc. That is what is meant by sensory existence. It hasn't really got anything to do so much with the world out there. The world out there is sort of irrelevant again. It's about the world inside of us. And that world inside of us is really the existence in the sense sphere, or the existence in the form sphere, right? It is something you experience directly, personally. It's not something larger that you are necessarily part of. That's not, at least not the main purpose or the main point of this. So sometimes little differences in translation like that can make a little bit of a difference in our understanding. And you may not even be aware of it, but still it may have an impact on your mind just by reading it in a certain way. So in Buddhism, it is experience that matters, not the world out there is kind of irrelevant. And then the Buddha says that this is how it works, right? This is then how it works. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So this is these are all the people who are not arahants yet. Hindered by ignorance. Ignorance is this mass of darkness, right? Which makes us not being able to see reality as it actually is. We start off in Buddhism, slowly our eyes kind of open up. Slowly the light is turned on. We start to see things in a new way. And as a consequence of that, ignorance is diminishing gradually, and a certain degree of understanding is arising here. And what I love, one of the quotes from the sutta that I like to mention which I mention every year usually, or every time I do a retreat, I talk about this, because I find it such a powerful simile for what is meant by this idea of ignorance or delusion, or not really understanding things properly here. And this is this idea, when you eventually, you come to the very end of the Buddhist path, you practice the samadhis, and then you gain the insights, right? The recollection of past lives, the understanding of the law of karma, and then eventually the destruction or the ending of the asavas, of these corruptions of the mind. And the simile there is that it's like a chick, right? A chick inside the eggshell. And one day, the little chick, it breaks out of that eggshell, right? And then, wow, then you see the world. So the idea here is that as long as we have this avijja, as long as we are deluded, as long as we have wrong view, it's like we are inside this eggshell, right? We have this very limited understanding of the world. We hardly see anything at all. We are kind of completely in darkness. We can only see as far as the eggshell, as far as the eggshell goes. It's almost nothing. And then one day, you break out of that eggshell. And wow, this is what the world is like. It's completely different. It's this enormous place. You can see to the horizon all these different creatures, all these different things going on. And that is what it's like to when ignorance gradually gets dispelled. You see things in a completely different way. And of course, and a very important part of that is this idea of rebirth. Suddenly you see the sequence of life stretching out in all directions. Whereas now we are kind of trapped in seeing only this tiny little fraction of existence that's always been here. And of course, that is a very limiting. It's like being enclosed in that eggshell. We can't see beyond that because our physical organism limits our mind to actually being able to see those things. And for that reason, we can't see it. So we are in darkness, basically. That's what the Buddha is saying. We don't see. And that is why the Buddha is often called the eye of the world. That Buddha is the first who sees, right? And then he tells us, wow, I have seen something astonishing. I have seen something which is, is helpful for everybody. Listen to this. This is actually the actual reality. And then you hear the Buddha think, yeah, maybe you have a point. And you start practicing, and gradually you start to see what the Buddha himself saw. So this is what this is about. So we are hindered by ignorance, right? We don't really know what's going on. We're kind of fumbling in the dark, trying to find our way through this. And it can be so difficult because of that avidya, which is stopping us from seeing these things. And we are fettered by craving. Craving is what ties us to the round of samsara. Craving is the thing, which leads to rebirth, which ties us down and keeps us moving around and around from one life to the next one. So fettered by craving, right? The fetter is the kind of rope or the shackle that binds us to this existence. We are like slaves being bound. We cannot really find that satisfaction because of this being fettered to something problematic. Right, so it's very evocative, this hindered by ignorance, fettered by craving, avidya nivarana, tanha sangyojana, something like that. I'm not sure exactly what the Pali is here, but something like that. So for these beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, kamma is the field. The field is where your consciousness is now. Your consciousness is established in a certain level. That is like the field, right? It is like this play area, this whole kind of realm where you are hanging out. And you can see, imagine yourself, if you get reborn in the future, you get reborn in a certain realm. It's like, this realm is like the field again. The field where you kind of, it is equivalent to the field that you experience inside of yourself and the field that you get reborn into the future. These are equivalent things. So this way, karma is the field, and that karma creates that sphere, and then your consciousness gets kind of planted into that field, right? You get reborn there in the future. You are like karma, consciousness is like the seed which gets planted into that existence. And then craving is the moisture which nourishes that consciousness and allows that plant to grow from that seed. You crave, you do actions as a consequence of craving. And because you do actions, you are creating states of consciousness, creating different levels and qualities of consciousness as a consequence of that. It's like your karmic accumulation is growing, and this is like saying consciousness itself is growing, and the plant kind of gets firmly established with roots in that particular existence as a consequence. You can see here the connection between karma in one life and then the rebirth as a consequence. Existence is that continuation of existence from one life to the next one, and how it kind of fits together. I hope this is kind of starting to make sense to you now. This is how the consciousness is established in an inferior realm, it's called here, right? The realm of sensuality. The point here is not to denigrate sensual pleasures. I think we have to be very careful with that, because if you denigrate them, it just makes life miserable again. That's not the point, to denigrate anything. It's just to remind ourselves that there is something higher. There is something more beautiful, something more powerful, something more meaningful, something more satisfying, something more complete, available there if we do the practice in the right way. That is the point of saying it is an inferior realm. It's just comparing it to something else, really. In this way, there is the production of renewed existence in the future. In this way, there is rebirth, basically. There you are. That is how this sutta explains that. And of course, that is then explained also for the other types of existence, the form existence, in the same way. If, Ananda, there were no karma ripening in the form realm, would form sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness to be established in a middling realm. In this way, there is production of renewed existence in the future. For the Buddha, you know, the samadhi states, they are like the middling realm, right? So very kind of high, everything is set at a very high level here, the way this is. So same idea as before, but now we are instead dealing with the jhanic states, or the samadhi states. If, Ananda, there were no karma ripening in the formless realm, would formless sphere existence be discerned? No, Bhante. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture for the consciousness to be established in a superior realm. In this way, there is the production of renewed existence in the future. In this way, Ananda, it is in this way, Ananda, that there is existence. Okay, so there you are. That is the Buddha's way of talking about existence, how we go from the karma in one life and how that affects also the re-arising of the person in a future existence, how it all ties together here. Okay, I guess we can move on to the next sutta, have a look at that one. And this is, again, more little bit more of the same, but it has some nice similes down here which talk about how the mind kind of creates the world in its great diversity. And quite nice similes. So let's have a look at that as well. This sutta is called The Leash, and we are now, this is from the Kanda Sangyutta, the Sangyutta, the connected discourses on the five aggregates, the five aspects of existence. And this is how it goes. Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So we have already seen pretty much all of these ideas already during this retreat, and here they kind of all come together in one kind of big crescendo, all of these ideas. The samsara is without discoverable beginning. That is what I was talking about before, the idea that you cannot discover a beginning. The Buddha doesn't say there is no beginning, he just says you can't actually find a beginning here. And that is the Buddha's kind of pragmatic way of saying just what is actually can be said about the universe, and not kind of jumping to a conclusion that there is no beginning just because one cannot be found. The first point is not discerned of these beings roaming on and wandering on, right? I really like this translation, the idea of roaming and wandering. To roam has this feeling of point of, you don't know where you're heading, right? You're just roaming around, kind of this random walking, the random movement from one place to another one, not really going anywhere. And this is very different, it seems. You know, when we think about our lives, we often feel a sense of purpose in our lives, especially when we are young, perhaps. As we grow older, we start to wonder, well, actually, where is all this going? But when you are young, it's like, oh yeah, it's, you know, it has a purpose. I've got to get out and get a job and kind of have a career for myself and get married and maybe have children and all these kind of things. And it all seems like there is a purpose there. But then you do all of those things and you start wondering, well, so now what? You know, what happens next? Is that really all there is to it? Okay, I've had a job, done a career, I've been married for all these years, I've had children and whatnot. And then what? Is that all there is to it? What kind of purpose is that really? Is that really a purpose? Has it given any final conclusion or solution to life? Does this really give any final satisfaction or whatever? And of course, the reason why we think all of these things are a purpose in life is because we somehow imagine that this is going to give some satisfaction, some contentment, is going to fulfill us somehow. But then we find out that after doing all of that, you find out it actually was just like a lie almost. It was just delusion. It wasn't real. That satisfaction never really came. And then when towards the end of our lives, we start to understand that we have just been roaming around, doing what everybody else does, without really thinking for ourselves how purposeful it was. And then we start to kind of move towards more perhaps spiritual practice. And in India, in those days, it was very common for people, you know, when you get old, you would kind of go forth into society, you become an ascetic or whatever, and you start practice the spiritual life. And it is often like that, right? When you get older, you start to wonder, what is the purpose of all this? Okay, now is the time to practice the spiritual life. But ideally, you kind of get these things, you understand this while you are as young as possible. The younger you are, when you start understanding this, the more possibility there is to do something about it and not be too trapped by these things. So you might as well get these things kind of straight at the beginning, right? Wondering, well, actually, what is really the point of all this? Am I really going anywhere? Or am I just doing the same thing again and again? Am I roaming around? Or am I actually going towards some kind of purpose and aim? So I find this is very kind of this Buddhist idea of actually quite aimless, not really having too much point to it, roaming around, wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, as we saw just before. And then the Buddha goes on. Suppose, because a dog tied up on a leash was bound to a strong post or pillar, If it walks, it walks close to that post or pillar. If it stands, it stands close to that post or pillar. If it sits down, it sits down close to that post or pillar. If it lies down, it lies down close to that post or pillar. So too, bhikkhus, if the uninstructed worldling regards form thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. He regards feelings, perceptions, willed activities and consciousness thus, this is mine, this I am, this is myself. If he walks, he walks close to those five aggregates subject to clinging, these five personality, the five aspects of personality. If he stands, he stands close to these five aspects of personality. If he sits down, he sits down close to these five aspects of personality. If he lies down, he lies down close to those five aspects of personality. Right? Whatever we do, these five aspects of personality, these five khandhas, these are the things that are always close to our heart. This is where we find ourselves. This is what we think we are. This is me, right? This is mine. I am this. This is myself. And this is kind of all this a sense of identity. We identify with these things. And we always keep on identifying with these things. And this is the point here. It doesn't matter where you get reborn. It doesn't matter where in samsara you are. It doesn't matter what life it is or whatever it is. It is always the same thing. It is always these things that are close to you and nothing else. The five aspects of personality, feelings, perceptions, consciousness, the willed activities. This is what it is. Just before we were talking about clinging and attachment. And there we were talking about in part, clinging attachment to the sensory objects of the world and sensory experience, right? We're talking about clinging and attachment to views and all of these things. But really, all of that comes in under the five, these five khandhas, these five aggregates. It's all part of that. Why is it that we attach to sensory experience? Because we find a sense of delight there. We think we own this. This is my house, right? It's my house. I own this house. This is part of that. And then there is a feeling associated with that. There's a positive feeling. My house, my home, my relationship, whatever it is, my view of existence. We feel positive about that. And where you feel positive about something, it is really that feeling which is the important thing here. And that feeling is part of the five aggregates, how you look at that world. So in a sense, all of these things actually comes back to these five aggregates of existence. So that is what we cling to. Everything is part of this. This is the sum total of experience. Therefore, bhikkhus, one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred and delusion. Or if you like, maybe better to say desire, ill will and confusion. Through the defilements of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. So here, I guess this is just a very brief exposition of the path, right? Okay, so the reason why this has been happening is because of these problems in the mind, the problems of desire, ill will, and confusion or delusion. This is why I've been going around tied to this post, right? This post is this idea of I am this, this is mine, etc. And the only way to get away from that is to start to get rid of those defilements and to purify the mind. That is how we get untied from that post. The leash gets cut and you feel free as a consequence. Then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, have you seen the picture called Faring On? It's just the name of a picture. I don't know exactly. Nobody really knows exactly what that refers to. It's a picture. Yes, Venerable Sir, even that picture called Faring On has been designed in its diversity
by the mind, that the mind is even more diverse than the picture called faring honor. I guess the idea here is that anything that that we create in the world, right? All the artwork, I don't know, when you start to look at art, boy, it's very varied and diverse, but all of that, of course, ultimately is created by the mind. But the mind is more diverse. It all comes from the mind. The mind is the originator of all of this. The mind is broader than all of that combined, basically. Therefore, because one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus, for a long time this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred and delusion, by desire, ill will and confusion. Through the defilements of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. That is how you overcome that. Because I do not see any other order of living beings so diversified as those in the animal realm. Even those beings in the animal realm have been diversified by the mind, yet the mind is even more diverse than those beings in the animal realm. Right? Where do all the animals come from? And all the animals come from the diversity of the mind. The mind is inclined in a certain direction, in a certain way, which corresponds to a particular realm in the animal world. The animal world is incredibly diverse. Right, if you think about all the various kinds of animals, the monkeys, the giraffes, the fish, right, and all the birds and snakes and what have you, and of course all the insects and all the kind of minute life that is, it's very, very diverse. All of that is created by the mind. The mind is kind of inclining towards these states of being, because the mind is inclining. It's like you are, in a sense, your mind is already partly that in this life, so you get reborn that as a consequence, created by the mind. The mind creates all of these things. Therefore, because one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus, for a long time this mind has been defiled by greed, ill will, and confusion. Through the defilements of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. If you don't get on with the job and purify yourself, you are going to keep on creating this stuff in the future, creating all these realms, creating all these things, and that is a problem. Suppose, because an artist or a painter using dye or lac or turmeric or indigo or crimson would create a figure of a man or a woman complete in all its features, on a well-polished plank, or a wall, or a canvas. So too, when the uninstructed worldling produces anything, it is only form that he produces, only feeling that he produces, only perception that he produces, only willed activities that he produces, only consciousness that he produces. Right? This is what life is. This is life. It's always the same thing. Always comes back to these five khandhas, these five aggregates, these five things of existence. That's all there really ever is. And that's what keeps on going around and around and around. And we are like painters in a sense. Here you have this idea of somebody, an artist, painting the figure of a person, right? Using all kind of colors and painting that figure in exactly the same way. We are painting, creating things in our minds as we go along. We are actually creating that person we might be in a new existence. We create that person in our own minds, just like an artist painting the figure of a person in this life. Right? It's very kind of evocative of how we of the creative activities that we do ourselves. We make all of these things. And an interesting thing, of course, little minor point here, is this idea of the uninstructed worldling, the asuttava putujana, asuttava, the one who hasn't heard the instructions, the one who hasn't heard any teachings that talk about the reality as it actually is. And of course, especially the Dhamma, right? You don't know anything about the Dhamma. The worldling, the putujana, the many folk, the ordinary person. This is the person who goes on doing this. And as you start to become instructed, you become an instructed worldling for a while, and eventually you lose your worldliness altogether, and you become the Aryan disciple instead. And as you move in that direction, you produce less and less until eventually you stop producing altogether. You don't produce those figures anymore, and you don't become anything in the future as a consequence. So here, this is the productive, again, activity of the mind, right? It ties in with all the things I've been talking about how we cling and how we exist in a certain way. This is just a slightly different way of looking at that, how we produce the future, and then we get reborn as a consequence. So just for a little bit of interest, I thought, those similes are quite evocative, perhaps. Okay. So, now we are moving on to the next stage of dependent arising. We're moving on to existence being a condition for rebirth or birth in the future. And this is, perhaps maybe we should stop there, because that is actually what is coming up next. It's a slightly different angle, looking at things in a slightly different way. So instead of kind of doing that a little bit now and continuing afterwards, we're getting fairly close to the end of this session anyway. So maybe that is a good place to stop. But we're getting close now to the end of dependent arising, and hopefully perhaps we can come, maybe this afternoon we can come to the end of that, and then we can look more in more detail about some of the aspects of the actual practice after that, more detail on the on how to get rid of this ignorance, how to we go back to the beginning again. Now we have kind of looked at the forward movement of the path, how all these factors together, how they lead us on to old age and suffering and all the problems. And once you have seen the forward movement and you know that the cause of all this at the end is avidya, ignorance, delusion, then of course the next step is, how do we unravel that delusion? And that is what we, of course, really is the most important point of this. How does this delusion disappear, get eliminated? And that is what, of course, the whole path, the whole Noble Eightfold Path, the whole gradual training is all about that. Anyway, that is enough for now, and I'll see you again this afternoon at 3:00.